This week on the Backtable Podcast.
I think overall, for a lot of physicians and interventional radiologists, I think we have a lot of really good ideas. We definitely have a huge advantage when it comes to building businesses because we actually see the need. Like, I see a need in things I do every single day. I think, oh, wouldn't it be great if I had this and make my, you know, clinical practice better and make my patients safer and make the treatment more efficacious. But a lot of the times we kind of don't know how to go about it. I think for these things, we should really just have more of an open mind to just think about things a little bit every single day, even if it starts off small, to kind of pursue how to like build those devices, because I think we owe it to ourselves and our patients as well.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Backtable Podcast, your source for all things interventional and endovascular. You can find all previous episodes of our podcast on iTunes, Spotify, and on backtable.com. First, a brief message from our sponsor.
This episode is supported by Reflow Medical. As makers of high-performance medical devices for peripheral and coronary interventions, Reflow asks the question, what's in your toolbox? Leading physicians rely on Reflow's suite of catheters for improved CTO crossing, vascular access, and complex PCI procedures, precision tools for even the most challenging cases. It's all about providing solutions for the unmet clinical needs. For more information, visit reflowmedical.com.
Now, back to the episode.
Today, we've got a great episode. We're going to be talking about the origin story of RadioClash, a company focused on enhanced electroporation with future applications in electroimmunotherapy with Dr. John Chow. We are going to learn about John's entrepreneurial journey, but also learn a bit about electroimmunotherapy and what this new technology brings. In case you missed it, we did recently release an episode covering immunotherapy in HCC with Ed Kim, Tyler Sandow, and Terrence Gade. That's episode 402. Be sure to check that out as well if you want to learn more about immunotherapy. John, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Aaron, for having me here.
John, I'm excited to have you on because we're doing the typical innovation episode where we're kind of telling your origin story of this new technology, but also educating our fellow IRs on what, I mean, look, there's some guys like myself who didn't really learn much about electroporation therapy in training. There's not a whole lot of information on it once you're out in practice, unless you're doing it and getting trained on it. So it'd be great to learn for you also to educate myself and our colleagues on that, as well as get a little bit more information around how it works together with immunotherapy with your technology. So appreciate you coming on the show.
Thanks. Yeah, it's a little bit unique story the way I actually got into it. I came out of basically undergrad. I was an undergrad in Montreal. I'm not a Canadian citizen. So when my visa, like study visa retired, or I guess expired, I packed up about 4 years of my life to 2001 Honda Odyssey and made it across the nation to Houston, where I landed a job in research at MD Anderson. Didn't know I wanted to do medicine then, didn't know anything about ablation therapies, and ended up in a lab working on electroporation. So it was kind of a unique start for me on that portion.
That's cool. Yeah, I mean, that was going to be one of my questions is how did you get interested in this topic? You covered that for me, but so what was your undergrad degree like? Typical biology? Obviously, it wasn't pre-med, right?
No, it wasn't pre-med exactly. It ended up covering everything in pre-med besides maybe like, I guess, a few like English classes here and there. But I went to undergrad. I know they keep changing the prerequisites, so I don't even know anymore. I'm too old. I'm way out from that. But I went to undergrad at McGill University, which is in Montreal. It was a fun experience. The city was French environments, but the university was in English. They had a really great science program, which I loved. So I ended up doing a undergraduate degree in anatomy and cell biology. But halfway through, I decided I really kind of wanted to explore more of the business side. So I got a degree in economics at that time as well, a minor in economics. So I always kind of had an inkling that I wanted to do something a little bit more business related too, but kind of with more of a science background.
Yeah. Well, it's good that you got that foundation early on. You know, a lot of us don't think about that. I was a zoology major. I feel like a lot of docs these days don't even do pre-med. They could be anything under the sun, and then they just kind of get the requisites at whenever they can. And then it's almost like that's what med schools are looking for nowadays, is like the students that kind of take a different path, right?
Oh, yeah, no, definitely. I think it's a very unique thing, I think, especially for the U.S. Since going to school in Canada and having a lot of friends when I was there who are also, I guess, in a sense, international, because when I was there, I'm not Canadian, right? I'm an American student in a Canadian university. So I was hanging out with a lot of other people from different countries too, like Hong Kong, France, parts of the Middle East, Egypt, UK. For them, if they wanted to go into medicine, it was a straight and narrow path. You had to do these exact things. I guess for a lot of people applying to American schools, it wasn't really like that. They wanted something, a different perspective on things, which in my opinion, I think it's a positive. I think that's why we have a lot of American doctors who tend to be entrepreneurs and things of that nature.
Yeah, I mean, before we started, we were talking about our common colleague, Steve Yevich, who's been on the show, who I went to med school with. And at Tulane, we had people from all different backgrounds and different majors. I mean, there was some music and English majors in my class and just like, wow, what sparked this interest in medicine? I like seeing people with different backgrounds. So fast forward, you're doing this research at MD Anderson. What happens next to inspire you to actually go to med school?
Well, when I was doing this research, I was just kind of already doing cancer research at McGill. So it was a natural sort of pathway for me to go to Anderson at first and do more cancer research. At that time, I kind of thought I wanted to be a patent lawyer, to be honest with you. I had this whole entire idea in my brain of some sort of courtroom drama. I think there are two types of people in the world. There's, I guess, people who treat, I guess, life as more of like a game. I guess you try to win at life. You have the things, the check mark and the boxes to win at life. And I think there's another group of people who kind of think about life more of like a story. I guess you want good stories. You want to say you did this. You want to say you did that. Look back and you'll smile at it. Not so much, you know, win at it per se. So I guess I would be more of like the second type. I'm more like a passion driven person. So I thought, oh, I want to be a patent lawyer. You know, I want to see all the great discoveries like Thomas Edison, be able to really defend those things. So I started basically when I got to Houston, while I was working at Anderson, cold calling a bunch of random lawyers, ones in New York, some of the larger law firms I don't really want to disclose. And you won't believe the amount of people who, if they are unhappy with their lives, who are willing to talk to you, to vent to you. So I got a lot of people telling me who are senior level that to not do it. And then I started reconsidering, talked to some of my friends who are in med school, and I got in touch with some physicians, and they seemed to really enjoy what they were doing and the patient interaction. So that's kind of how I pivoted while I was doing research. It kind of seamlessly pivoted into medicine over there.
Got it. And then did you end up staying at MD Anderson for med school?
No, I ended up going to Texas A&M. So at that time, I was a Texas resident, and I don't think Anderson had a med school, actually.
Oh, yeah, yeah, you're right. I was thinking, yeah, so it's university. It would have been university.
Exactly, University of Texas. Yeah, Health Science Center at Houston. Yeah, but I ended up going to Texas A&M, which ended up being a year and a half in College Station. I never went to a football game, unfortunately. About 2.5 years at Houston Methodist, where we did all of our clinical training.
Got it. Okay. And so, like, you talked about you got this minor in business. You were thinking about being a patent lawyer. Did you have any entrepreneurial tendencies growing up, like even as young as like middle school, high school, having your own little like candy business or something like that? Anything or, you know, something that maybe ran in the family?
Yeah, I guess. Well, my family, half of them actually do business. We were talking just before we went on air, but you're in Paris right now. My grandpa actually lives in Paris right now as well. He got over there because he had like business deal. Basically. So I guess I got it from their side of the family, my mom's side of the family. Everybody on their side of the family does business. Everybody on my dad's side of the family is a huge nerd, all science people. So I guess it was a good mix. But I started maybe as early as, I guess, when I was in fifth grade. I grew up in upstate New York, not very much to do, really. It's pretty boring up there, a lot of woods, rivers and stuff. So me and my friend Ryan would go and mow lawns, and it snows a lot, so we'd shovel driveways for $10 a pop when we were like 10. It's a lot of money for a 10-year-old at that time. My parents would always be like, where'd you get this money? Like, oh yeah, just shoveled Mr. Smith's driveway down the road. And they're like, who's Mr. Smith? So it's a little bit disconcerting. There are 10-year-olds approaching strangers in the neighborhood for cash. Yeah, started off there. And then in college as well, I started getting into my economics minor. I really like to practice what I learn. I'm not really like a sit and read guy. I'll do it if I have to, but I'm more of like an actual person. So I guess between junior year and senior year, when I decided I wanted to do that economics minor, I quit my job in the lab when I was doing developmental genetics at that time. They were paying me. And much to my parents' dismay, I decided to start Montreal's first pop-up taco shop. So it was called JQ's Taco Delivery. And It was an interesting format, but there was horrible Mexican food in Montreal. I'm sorry to say that. I'm sure it's better now. But as American, you know, there's Mexican food everywhere. And now I'm like in Montreal, there's no Mexican food. I was very alarmed. I feel like I had to do something about it.
It was a good opportunity to learn how to create a concept from the idea all the way through the finish. We assembled a good team. My roommate had graduated from chef school, so that kind of helped a bit. So it was great. We paid for a whole entire 4 months of rent that summer, and they wanted, some of my friends thought I should franchise it, but I wasn't going to drop out of school to franchise a taco pop-up shop. But yeah, we paid for a whole entire summer, except I did not have enough money for internet, which was okay.
That's amazing. That is a great entrepreneurial story. And yeah, much like Montreal, we need JQ's Taco Shop here in Paris because there's zero Mexican food, or they're, even what they call Mexican food is not, it's just horrible. And having lived in Texas for 10 years, it's the first thing I get when I fly in. I go straight to Mi Cocina or any of the other Tex-Mex places and get some tacos. So yeah, I feel you.
Yeah, I 100% agree. So, you know, one of my cousins and her friends in Paris, too, because, yeah, my grandpa lives there, so we have family there. They asked me what my favorite food was when I visited. Last time I said tacos, and they asked me what a taco was. And I said, you know, it's kind of like, have you ever had like a shawarma or a gyro? But it's like a Mexican version of that. And they're like trying to wrap their minds around it. So,
right.
Very it's different
no, there's
concept.
No falafel in it. Yeah. Yeah, no, that's great. That's great. I love that. All right. Well, so let's get into Radio Clash, right? So you finished med school. You went on to radiology training. Did you go straight the direct IR pathway or did you do diagnostic and then the other pathway?
I was one of the first ones to go into the direct IR pathway. So I think the actual pathway was about 3 years, like available for 3 years. And I was the third one at that time.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was great. I knew I wanted to do IR. You know, some of my biggest mentors at that time in med school were Dr. Yevich, who wrote my recommendation letter, Josh Cuban over at Anderson too, and then Orlando Diaz, who's a neuro IR over at Houston Methodist. And after having worked with them, I knew I wanted to do IR specifically and basically only applied to IR.
Cool. Yeah. So where were you in your training when the original idea for like, were you, like even during residency, were you continuing to do research on electroporation?
No, I think I kind of had stopped doing research on any institutional level for irreversible electroporation by, I would say, probably 2016. So I was not really working at any institution doing that research past that date, but I had been very curious about it. So I'd kind of kept up with it privately because I knew it was something that was innovative and that was coming through the pipeline of a way to facilitate cancer vaccines. And especially with the discovery of immunotherapy in 2018 with Jim Allison, who was also at Anderson, I knew it was something I had to follow through on. But I really came up with the idea of this probe that can do electroporation plus injection, some sort of aqueous substance, be that, you know, chemotherapy, immunotherapy, or even just saline to enhance the actual ablation zone and increase safety for electroporation between med school and residency. I was unemployed for about a month. So I wasn't working anywhere. I was unemployed. I was at home twiddling my thumbs thinking, you know, what was I going to do? And I decided to go to SIR, which is Society of Interventional Radiology annual meeting over in Austin in 2019. And I saw at that time, I think that they technically still are the industry leaders in electroporation. It was AngioDynamics NanoKnife. There was a rep over at SIR, and they had a whole entire booth talking about their investigative device exemption trial for stage 3B pancreatic cancer that they were opening up. And I went kind of talked to her. I talked to her about some of the research even I was doing back in 2014 and 2015 in Dr. Mary Tess Melanson's lab, who was one of my largest research mentors. She really gave me a chance at understanding the science behind this. So I really appreciate that. Saying we have been doing experiments injecting chemotherapy into the tumor directly after electroporation. And in all those trials, it worked much better than any sort of just electroporation alone because it got a larger tumor ablation zone. And just like the electroporation alone, we'd use as our control. And a lot of times those cancers would come back. So I was kind of talking to her about this. And of course, she's a rep. Like some reps like understand a lot of stuff, but like some don't really understand like the nitty gritty when it comes down to experimental things. And of course, she's like, I have no clue what you're talking about. I'm trying to sell you a probe here. And then as I walked away from that conversation, I thought, someone should really like invent this, I guess. And I thought, maybe I should. So at that point, I dropped the patent, which was right in between med school and residency while I was unemployed and kind of built off of that.
Okay. And so that was, did you say that was 2019?
2019.
That's right. I was at that SIR. It was the last one before COVID. And then, because I was also in Dallas at the time, so I just drove down to Austin. Yeah. So, okay, well, fantastic. So 2019, you had the idea. What were the next steps? Like, where'd you go from there? Did you have a co-founder?
No. In the beginning, nobody would actually, I guess, touch the idea. They thought it was really nice. They thought it was just, you know, this is a great passion project, good for you sort of thing. But no one really wanted to be involved because it was early and it was risky. Especially, you talk to any sort of founder, especially a first-time founder, I think a lot of times nobody really believes in their idea. So you really got to believe in your idea like the most before anything. So it was just me for basically like a year. I had turned that prelim pen that my parents gave me $2,000 for. I begged them for that $2,000 into a utility patent when I started making money during my first year of residency. And then about a year and a half later, my little brother at that time wanted a summer internship. So technically, he was our first employee. I had him look up some, like, I guess, investment funds that we could kind of apply to. And after that, one of my med school friends, who is a dermatology resident, her husband had been doing startups in Austin for about a decade at that point, mostly software, but he was an electrical engineer as well. So he kind of caught on to this idea. He thought it was neat, made a few CAD models for us, shocked potatoes in the living room. We ended up sourcing our own material from Needham, Massachusetts, and Northside Houston, developed our own probe for about $2,500. And then from there, we ended up getting our third person, Sam Daria, who is out in New York. He had kind of approached us because a family member had cancer, learned about our device, and basically brought the finance side of us, made this whole entire science experiment more of a real business. So I guess, long story, no, I was really the only founder, but we now have three other people. It's me, myself, Dwayne Bester, who's our CTO, and Sam Daria, who is our CFO.
So when it came time for them to be like, okay, John, what do you want to call this company? How did you come up with Radio Clash?
Yes. So I was listening to The Clash and the song London Calling came through and I was, you know, jamming out to it. And I was like, I think this idea would be pretty cool if it called it like Radio Clash, because I'm an interventional radiologist and clash is a good word for a kind of creative destruction. So I thought it was, you know, interventional radiology techniques to, I guess, create new, like, I guess, surgical procedures in a, like a creative destructive way. So that's kind of how the name came about.
Fantastic. I love it. I love it when it's rooted in music. So tell us, like, when you guys first started, what was, you mentioned the finance guy that came in. What cancers did you have in mind, like, first and foremost? Was it HCC? Was it something else? Where did you see this working first and foremost?
I think originally we just wanted to target soft tissue ablation, mostly because that was the same indication. And that is still what we're targeting initially, because that's the same indication that all of our predicate devices have targeted, including AngioDynamics NanoKnife and a new ablation probe out there as well called Galvanized Alia System. They all target soft tissue ablation. But the way that I kind of want to see this used eventually is for Mets, metastatic cancer. Basically, eventually down the road with use of immunotherapy, intratumoral injection of immunotherapy. Initially, we're just kind of trying to get it approved for irrigation with saline, which will increase the safety of electroporation, but eventually it will be used for metastatic cancer. And the way that I kind of want to target this is things that interventional radiologists already do. Basically, ablations of tumors of the liver, spine, and also pancreas. That's kind of the first ones. Right now, there are a few trials out there from some of our predecessors who had been targeting cancers of the skin. So melanoma, breast, a lot of those sort of therapies, you don't really need a probe to do it because you can actually just visualize the lesion, right? There's no increased risk by saying, I'm going to put an electroporation probe on a skin lesion and then just inject some sort of substance in the skin lesion because you can visualize it. But if you're going to translate that to somewhere deep inside the body, you really want something that's kind of physician preferred, one stick, just one probe, no multiple probes. You don't have to sneak a second needle in there to try to do all this stuff because each time you do that, it increases risk to the patient. So ours is really for deep seated tumors inside the body.
And just real quick, I want to talk about how electroporation works here in a minute. But in terms of bone, I mean, I guess, you know, I think of bone, you know, RFA or, like, for example, osteocool and radiofrequency ablation. You drill into the bone and then you have a heated ablation zone. How does it work with bone and electroporation?
So
I'm going to kind of go through a 10,000-foot overview just to sort of the different modalities. I wrote a paper back on this over for SIR. If you want to look on their website, I kind of talk about all the different types of ablation modalities, but there are really like only three big categories. There's thermal ablation, which is going to be microwave ablation and radiofrequency ablation. Those destroy tumors basically by coagulative necrosis. It basically chars the entire sort of tumor. It gets rid of everything. It kind of melts it away in a way, including all the antigens. And then there's another type of therapy called cryoablation that basically works by freezing the actual tumor or soft tissue, what have you, until it reaches sub-zero temperature. Everything dies and it basically shears. That's unique because it actually preserves antigens. So it allows for immunogenicity for if you want to develop some sort of immune response to that type of cancer. The third type of ablation is the one that is least well known. That's electroporation therapy. This therapy is not thermal and it is not cryo. What it does is it basically applies a voltage potential across a cell membrane in a tumor and punches a bunch of holes all throughout that cancer cell or, you know, any sort of cell. Once those holes are in the cell membrane, everything from inside the cell leaks to the outside of the cell. And that cell loses homeostasis, and that's how the cell basically dies. But the unique thing about electroporation is it preserves the actual tumor antigens. So unlike, say, microwave ablation or radiofrequency ablation, which chars all the antigens, electroporation preserves those tumor antigens. So if you are going to basically try to generate an immune response to get the body to create an immune response against your own cancer antigens, electroporation is the way to go because those cancer antigens basically remain and then you can actually generate that type of thing. There are reports in the literature from as old as I think in the 1970s of something called the abscopal effect, which is the first time I heard that phrase was I was on an away rotation over at Stanford with Dr. Huang and she kind of mentioned the abscopal effect to look into it. And I realized it's an effect that in certain populations, the body will create an immune response to their own cancer cells. And when they create that immune response to their own cancer cells, you basically have your own immune cells swimming around in your body that can attack cancer with the same profile anywhere. So if that cancer had spread, say, from like the leg to say like the lung, you create immune response to the leg cancer. The tumor in the lung will go down because you have those same immune cells attacking those cancer cells in the lungs. So I thought that was an amazing thing. Where electroporation basically is the one that facilitates the most immunogenic response for that.
Fantastic. So I remember hearing about electroporation, you know, several years ago. Why do you think that this has not caught on as quickly, or is it just that new that just more research needs to be done? Like, what are the limitations of it versus those other ones, the thermal and the cryo?
So I think the reason why it didn't catch on as much as the other ones was that it was used not properly, to be honest with you. If I'm just going to ablate an actual tumor, just try to get rid of that tumor by itself, I would always try to go with microwave ablation probably. Or if I was going to go, say, lung, maybe I'll do cryo. But I think
if it's just localized to that area.
Exactly. Because that's always a better like one-off. You want to just get rid of something equivalent to surgery, microwave ablation would be like my number one thing to go to. I think with irreversible electroporation, they had kind of marketed it as a way, because it's non-thermal, as a way to preserve the structures. Like I said beforehand, unlike microwave, it doesn't, destroy all the structures around it. So it was kind of billed as you can do irreversible electroporation in the pancreas, near the portal vein, near all this vasculature, and it won't disrupt those vascular structures. But that's true to a degree, but it wasn't really as effective, I would say. I think the best way to be using this eventually in the future is via injection of an immunotherapy for Mets. So there are a few sort of trials that had gone on beforehand. One was KEYNOTE 695 that had demonstrated for patients with metastatic melanoma who had spread from, you know, the skin to the brain. They'd failed every type of immunotherapy, chemotherapy that were systemic, radiation, and surgery. If you did electroporation locally onto that actual skin tumor and then injected a type of pro-oncolytic virus, pro-inflammatory cytokine plasmid in that area, IL-12, which is type immunotherapy, 10% of those patients went into partial remission and 4% went into complete remission, meaning that the lesion in the brain had gone away.
So I think that's really the way we want to use electroporation. And those results came out late last year. So this is something that's coming out very sort of as we speak. And there's another trial right now called PanFire 3, which is exploring a similar type of thing for pancreatic cancer. So I think we've really sort of hit the gold mine with how we want to approach electroporation therapy, because now we have immunotherapy as a way to help charge the immune system for a proper use of electroporation.
That's a great summary, because for those in the audience who aren't aware, maybe you've heard the acronym IRE, irreversible electroporation. That's what I was referring to before, where you heard about it, but it seemed to be not catching as much, I guess, attention as the other ablation therapies when it came to ablating focal tumors. And like you said, like you very eloquently described, the abscopal effect really makes it advantageous for metastatic disease, because you can also inject the immunotherapy. So,
exactly.
So tell us about your technology and how it facilitates this combined therapy.
So for our technology, initially, we eventually want to get to a point where we are injecting localized immunotherapy into the actual tumor after electroporation. But we're starting off a little bit simpler. We're starting off with just irrigation of saline into the actual tumor bed. Right now, IRE is supposed to be non-thermal, but for the experiments I had done beforehand back at Anderson 2015 and prior to that, not quite sure if that is exactly true, to be honest with you. Whenever we do the actual histological analysis, there's always a bit of charring. But there are papers that have come out of Northwestern which showed that if you irrigate with saline before the actual electroporation, it actually decreases the temperature of the actual electroporation, making it a safer mode and also increasing the ablation zone as well. So what we're kind of starting off with is just irrigation of saline in that area to make it safer, to make electroporation safer and more efficacious. Similar to kind of what you were talking about with RFA for OsteoCool as well. Right now, there are, I think, 23 clinical trials right now for clinicaltrial.gov that are testing the efficacy of multiple types of immunotherapies with electroporation. PanFire 3 was one of the ones I was talking to about that I was most excited about, that they're doing intratumoral injection of an immunotherapy. I think it's a CPG, which is like a toll-like receptor that causes localized inflammation of the actual tumor. But none of those therapies right now have gotten FDA approval yet. One is on its way for IL-12 with electroporation, but we kind of want to wait to see which immunotherapy gets approved first. Once that gets approved first, then we'll resubmit to the FDA for that immunotherapy. But in the meantime, we're basically making a probe that's just a single stick probe. So unlike, say, like NanoKnife, which makes you do at least two probes, up to six probes, 1 to 3 centimeters away to do the electroporation, ours is just a single probe. There's an adjustable ablation zone that you can adjust between 1 to 4 centimeters to cover the length of the tumor. And wherever you have that tumor like fully covered by our adjustable ablation zone, on the inner trocar, there are about 0.4 millimeter pores along that exact length that you can irrigate saline out of to increase the safety of electroporation and also increase the actual total area of the electroporation. And then eventually, when there's a drug, I believe in the very near future, that will be approved by the FDA, then we will encourage injection of that immunotherapy through our device after we get it approved through the FDA as well. The device itself, I'm sorry, I'm a horrible salesman. It's called the RadioClash Electroporation Device. I couldn't come up with a better acronym, so it's just like the RED, but yeah, it's the problem we're solving for.
Well, that's cool. When you're talking about injecting saline through these little pores, actually within the tumor itself, is that for better distribution or maybe more equal distribution? Is that why it creates like a better safety profile? Or can you tell us a little bit more about why that works?
Sure. So like I said beforehand, electroporation is supposed to be non-thermal. So it's not supposed to increase the temperature. That's one of the things why it's supposed to make it better than microwave or, say, radio frequency ablation. But sometimes it does create charring locally because there is a bit of increased temperature in that area. But if you irrigate saline in the tumor microenvironment, the saline decreases the maximal temperature. So it makes it sort of like a more ideal form of electroporation. That's what makes it safer.
I see. So it's more temperature control to help minimize that charring that can happen. I see. Okay.
Exactly. Because the electroporation doesn't really destroy the cells via temperature increases anyway. It's supposed to punch holes
in the cell membrane. So this just, you know, makes the temperature even less. So it preserves the vascular structures surrounding where you're trying to do the electroporation better. And then also the saline acts as a conductant too. So it can increase the field of electroporation because it kind of helps facilitate the diameter of the charge.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, and so the other question I had was, when it comes to immunotherapy, or if you're injecting, you know, I know there was that study before with chemotherapy in combination with electroporation. Does it matter if you're injecting the immunotherapy before or after the charge? Is it better after the charge?
I think that's something to be explored. There is definitely a temporal effect between it. I think it would probably be better, just from my experiences with injecting chemotherapy after electroporation, that it would be better after the charge. And the reason for that is I think the charge itself might cause some sort of modulation, or I wouldn't say damage, but some sort of modification to immunotherapy if it's already in that area. I just remember when I was previously doing electrochemotherapy experiments back in MD Anderson, we would do things, like inject the chemotherapy 1 minute before electroporation, or inject the chemotherapy, 30 seconds after electroporation. And I think from some of those results, the after was a bit better.
Okay. That makes sense for sure. And it makes sense that it could alter the therapy itself. And so it'd be safer to do it afterwards. And because, ultimately you just want the antigen to be exposed to the immunotherapy, right? So that the immunotherapy can do its work in the rest of the body.
Exactly. And it kind of electroporation also is a unique way of softening up the stroma around some of this, because some people would just say, why not just do systemic immunotherapy after you do electroporation, right? You know, like there are trials for that as well, which are demonstrating good results. But a lot of times the tumor is sequestered by stroma. Like a slam dunk sort of example of that would be pancreatic cancer. It has a pretty strong stroma around it. So a lot of times if you do systemic immunotherapy, even if you want it to, interact with the actual tumor, it can't reach it because of the actual stroma. Electroporation will permeabilize that stroma, allow for the interaction of the immune cells and the tumor antigens. That was a paper originally that was published in 2018 by one of my mentors, Dr. Mary Tess Melanson, and June Joe out of Chun Li's lab at MD Anderson in Nature Communications, that kind of kicked off this whole entire idea of immunotherapy with electroporation.
You mentioned that earlier in the conversation. You know, it's really fascinating, the possibilities, because my next question is, I wonder, let's say somebody has metastatic breast because it tends to go everywhere,
mm-hmm.
and they have multiple liver lesions, but then they might have lesions, they might have bone lesions as well. When we think about typical ablation, cryo, or RFA, and someone who's a non-surgical candidate, we're treating multiple lesions in the liver. Do you see there being a need to even treat multiple lesions, or maybe just treating a dominant lesion and then seeing how they react to the immunotherapy afterwards, and therefore kind of minimizing the amount of electroporation that they have to undergo?
Yeah, you hit the nail right on the head, Aaron. That's the way I basically envision this going. We treat the dominant lesion, and then basically a dominant lesion should have the most, I would say, heterogeneous antigens as well, because it's kind of gone through mutation. So whatever kind of spread would probably have some sort of antigenic profile similar to that dominant lesion. And then we wait for the localized immune response to develop T cells that target the same antigens as that dominant lesion, and then try to wait for that systemic abscopal effect, which the T cells go around the body and attack the sort of satellite lesions. I don't think this thing is going to replace other types of therapy. I think this is going to be an adjunct therapy. We still want to debulk. If something is going to be a huge tumor, you still want to debulk those things, make people feel comfortable. But I think this is really going to be something that's going to help people that would otherwise kind of just be on lifelong immunotherapy or chemotherapy, where this kind of, at least in clinical trials, has demonstrated a subset of people shows possibility of a complete cure, which is kind of the whole entire idea here.
Yeah, which is amazing. But you mentioned something that's interesting. I mean, a lot of people are expecting immunotherapy to kind of turn cancer into just maybe a chronic disease that we deal with, just like high blood pressure and others, which would be something incredible as well. It's not a cure, but it's something that you're dealing with. And we do see that a lot oftentimes with patients. Well, I wanted to switch gears a little bit, because we talked a little bit about how it works, but I wanted to find out a little bit more about the challenges of actually building a company, getting funding, building a team. What was sort of the most unexpected difficulty with that for the physician entrepreneurs that are out there that are kind of thinking about taking the leap into building a company?
I will have to say that I want to start off with saying that no two founders' journey is identical. There's no actual book for this. Everything is like a learned experience along the way, so everybody's experience is unique. It is very challenging to at first kind of change your mindset from that of a physician or a scientist to somebody who's trying to build a company. When I first started this company, I came about it very clinically and very kind of scientifically. I would talk to people with PowerPoints as if I was presenting at SIR with all these graphs. And most people don't have the time, the attention span of, say, more than 5 or 10 minutes, I would have to say. And a lot of the stuff kind of goes over people's heads. You know, you're talking to people at SIR about this, people who are seasoned, people who graduated from med school, graduated from residency, have specialty expertise, and some of the people don't understand what you're talking about. So if you talk to something even more niche, people will just completely disregard what you're saying because they'll say, oh, that's a cool concept, but how does this relate to anything? It was very difficult at first getting started. The initial hardest thing for us to do was to try to build a prototype. I originally got connected with Ashok Gowda, who runs Biotex Inc. He was one of the co-founders for Visualase, which was a laser-mediated brain ablation probe that was acquired by Medtronic, I think in 2014. His other co-founder, I'm blanking on his name, is now, I think, the CEO of Inari. So he took kind of whatever he had kind of acquired from that, all the experience, and started Biotex out in Houston, Texas. He mentored me through a lot of how to kind of go about this, create a probe. I asked him, you know, could you help us make a prototype? And he said, $100,000. Seriously, though, which was not something that I had. And I said, well, how else can I go about this? He said, well, you can make your own. It's like, how do I do that? It was like, well, you know, you talk to suppliers. So I ended up sourcing my own materials, 3041 stainless steel from Needham, Massachusetts, found an electrical discharge manufacturing company in Northside, Houston, and a company I found online called American Hela Arc Welders. So we got our own things basically made, very specific. I have everything on PowerPoints. I got it welded. I was bending wires myself, ordering stuff off of Amazon, plugging the, you know, the female lure lock onto the proximal end of this device for the injection capability. We got it done for $2,500. That was a huge milestone for us because if we never got that done, then we wouldn't have gotten anything else. Once we got that accomplished, we kind of got a few more looks, got connected to a company over in Kansas City called RBC Medical, which had been doing some experiments with Dr. Raul Sheff over at Anderson as well. I think he does a lot of immunotherapy things with SIR. And we kind of worked with them over in Kansas City, connected our probe that we had made in my garage to their generator that was $1 million generator. And it worked. And we shocked potatoes in their lab, and it was wonderful. And then from there, we kind of started getting a few more looks. And then learning about the whole entire FDA process, speaking with investors who were saying we were too early back in 2001, and then learning all these keywords we didn't even know about, like what is a 510K approval process? What's a de novo approval process? What's PMA? All these things that people throw around, and just learning that whole entire thing. And then there was the patent ordeal as well. We originally submitted this thing in 2019 when I was unemployed, and then we got 3 rejections from the USPTO. Each time was, they said one thing. We had to submit what's called an RCE. It was a request for continuing exam. But thankfully, our lawyer is really great. He's like semi-retired, I think. His name is Eric P. Mirabel. He was the VP of IP for Tanix Inc., which was at that time the largest biomedical IPO in history. And they closed to Bristol-Myers Squibb in the early 2000s. So he's kind of like independently wealthy, but he decided to help us out because our original patent lawyer had retired, and they knew each other, I think, from like the Houston LBGT community. So it was a great connect from there. So every single thing was just like rolling a large stone uphill, finding out what these acronyms mean. I mean, it's harder than residency. I will have to tell you that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's amazing, man. I mean, we joke about IRs being MacGyvers. People like to kind of brag about that stuff, but you're like the real deal. I mean, you built this thing literally. Was this out of your garage? Was this in your house? Like, what was your space that you were working with?
It was in our living room. we were living out Incredible. Of some converted warehouse sort of thing in Eastside Houston. We had two rooms. So I was living there with my wife and we had two dogs. There was a bedroom which we converted to my wife's studio because at that time she was starting a lingerie design company. That's her background. She's from New York as well. Previously she had been doing like assisted lingerie designing for Macy's brand, you know, in Herald Square above like the where they have the parade and stuff. But she decided to move to Houston with me. Bad choice on her end, great addition on my end. But she wanted a studio where she wanted to design some of her stuff. So we turned the bedroom into her studio and we were living in the living room, basically with two dogs in the living room. And I was just making all the stuff in the living room, ordering agar from Amazon, getting those weird compostable sponges from Trader Joe's and just doing everything on our counter. Yeah, it looked like half the room looked like a science experiment most of the time, with weird wires, 9-volt batteries thrown around.
Man, and it reminds me of, we had Julio Palmez on the show a while back and Brian Harley interviewed him and he was talking about building his prototype in his garage for the first stent. And he was struggling and a lot of trips to the hardware store and everything. And then somebody was like installing or fixing their washer and dryer in their garage. And they left these little scraps of metal behind and he was like picking them up and like playing with them. And like he just stumbled upon like the right metal with that, you know, and it's so wild. It's so fun though, because it's not like you're sitting in the science laboratory. You're literally doing it in your living room.
No, exactly. And that's one of the most unexpected things. I had the best advice about doing that type of thing from, I think I would say, our person who had been like the biggest mentor to me on this. It's a guy named Jacob Kriegel. He was prior chief resident over at Columbia for cardiothoracic surgery when I was like an intern during my intern year. And he ended up developing a heart failure device for a company called Alleviant Medical. I think they just closed like $79 million Series C. And he was the co-founder for that. He'd been working on it for 7 years. And he always told me, he was like, John, you're going to find stuff in like the most unexpected ways. People are going to send you things just like out of the blue. Just read them and just constantly think about this. 1 or 2 hours a day, you're on the train, you're on a walk, just never stop thinking about it, because it's not like Rome's not built in a day. He's just like, just keep thinking about it. Those like pieces of scraps kind of remind me of it, because I've definitely come upon that a few times where I wasn't looking for the thing.
Right.
And then it was there and it just comes in the most unexpected ways.
Yeah. And like, think about, I mean, you were talking about, we started in the beginning where you're like, there's two people, that want to win the game and there's people who want to have interesting stories to tell. And you've already got those stories, right? It's not about the exit. It's about this whole process, right? And the stories that you get to tell by going through it. And so that's what I love about the startup world. It's not even, I mean, an exit's great and everything, but like the experience is the incredible part. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. It's been a great experience. But in order, one of the things is, as I learned along the way, is in order to get investors, you do need an exit plan as well, which we actually do have at this point as well. We're planning to basically get FDA grant approval probably midway through 2026. We have, you know, two FDA Q subs, which said that we're a 510K approval process. We have all of our manufacturers lined up. On the generator side, I can't say right now because of, I don't want to disclose. But on the pro manufacturing side, we're working with Biotex and Ashok. We're working with Lean Raka. The CEO, Michelle Lott, is amazing when she comes to, and her whole entire team, Valerie and Beth as well, basically getting us that pathway, which I think a lot of the larger companies didn't know how to. And then working with Eric for the IP side. But we have a full plan. Last year, we raised $2,500 based off our pre-seed, which got us to this area. We won the Columbia Venture Competition in 2001, which got us a little bit more money too. So we definitely have an exit strategy in 2026 after we get FDA grant. Yeah.
Fantastic. So that was one of my questions. I was like, where are you in the process of going to market? It sounds like, you know, you just told us about the FDA process. I know you want to talk a little bit about like maybe a seed round financing. Do you want to tell the audience about that?
So we are starting a seed round right now as well. So this will be our first priced round. We've already closed a round beforehand early last year through SafeNotes. And then we basically took that money and did everything we said we were going to do, plus more. With that money, we got an actual prototype designed. We have a patent. We've submitted more patents, and we got a FDA 510K pathway. With this new seed round, we're planning to basically build a RadioClash branded device plus generator combination that will fulfill the GLP animal lab testing required of us through the 510K process in order to get the grant, which is a fancy word for like approval with the FDA in 2026. So if you guys want any information on that, we'd be more than happy to share. Our email is info@radioclash.co. It's info@radioclash.co. I had to think about how to spell that for a second. But we are starting now, and we're kicking off our first pitch with some angel investors tomorrow.
Perfect. Awesome. I mean, and there's definitely some familiar faces on the advisory board. You got Josh Kuban, which we mentioned earlier, and Rahul Sheth as well. And it seems like a great team that you guys have put together. Anything that I left out that you think is essential for the audience to know?
I think just overall for a lot of physicians and interventional radiologists, but also for, you know, a lot of other specialties that I think are device heavy, vascular surgery, now neurosurgery in a lot of those places as well, cardiology. I think we have a lot of really good ideas. We definitely have a huge advantage when it comes to building businesses because we actually see the need. Like, I see a need in things I do every single day. I think, oh, wouldn't it be great if I had this and make my, you know, clinical practice better and make my patients safer and make the treatment more efficacious. But a lot of the times we kind of don't know how to go about it. And we're kind of afraid to go about it as well because we don't know where to start. I think for these things, we should really just have more of an open mind to just think about things a little bit every single day, even if it starts off small, to kind of pursue how to like build those devices. A lot of times when we see CEOs of these companies, they come from a finance background and they rely upon people like us to basically tell them how to do things. But really, we're the ones giving them a lot of the ideas on how to go about addressing these needs. So I would just really encourage a lot more, I guess, physician entrepreneurship, because I think we owe it to ourselves and our patients as well.
Yeah. I mean, one last thing before we finish up, if you don't mind me asking, you know, I know how it is trying to run a company plus clinical practice plus a family with very young children at home. How are you managing, and like, how are you? I know it's hard to answer that because it's kind of just, you just do it and it all kind of works out. But any advice in that realm? Because sometimes people are just like, oh, there's just not enough hours in the day. But there are, you just got to kind of figure it out.
Yes. So I think a lot of that was actually honed through my clinical training, in which had to, like, ever since first year, people would say, you know, be more efficient. How do you make 80-hour week clinically without breaking hours? You know, be more efficient. And I think part of that is like kind of what I had said earlier, my mentor, Jake Kriegel, told me, just keep thinking about it like all the time. Believe it or not, I do most of like the things for the company on a 40-minute train ride to and back from the hospital. That's about an hour and a half every single day. I do a lot in that time, basically. So that multiplied by, you know, five, that's a fair amount of time. That's like a full work day just dedicated to it. I wrote the entire utility patent on the train in the course of a week, there and back, just on my laptop. So I think a lot of stuff, there is time, kind of like downtime. And overall, I don't know, I'm an antsy person, so I kind of like can't sit still overall. But I think there is time to be made if you're really passionate about it and it's really important to you. And I think time shouldn't be a limiting factor for it. I have kind of chilled out a bit more on some of the research that I normally do. I have a 4-month-old, so I'm really enjoying spending a lot of time with my kid right now too.
Yeah, that's essential. Don't subtract from family time. Subtract from lesser priorities is my advice too.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, John, it's a great place to put a pin in it. Thank you so much for coming on and sharing your story. You said the contact information. We'll put that in the show notes as well. So if anybody wants to reach out to John to learn more about RadioClash, to learn more about the seed round, that will be in the show notes. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. We'll catch you next time.
Thanks, Aaron.
Thank you so much for listening. If you haven't already, make sure to subscribe, rate the podcast 5 stars, and share with a friend. If you have any questions or comments, direct message us @_backtable on Instagram, Twitter, or LinkedIn. Backtable is produced and hosted by myself, Aaron Fritz, and co-hosts
Chris Beck, Sabine Dong. Michael Barraza,
and Ali Behetti.
Our audio team is led by Kieran Gannon, with support from
Josh McWhirter,
Aaron Bolf, Nick Shellcross,
Josh Spencer.
Design and digital marketing led by Brian Schmitz.
Social media and PR by Ann Dang,
Manisha Naganathanahalli,
and Manveer Singh Subli.
Administrative support provided by Jamila Kinnebrew.
Intro and extra music is Ripperoo by Skeptic Moon. Find us on Spotify or at local live music venues in New Orleans, Louisiana.
Thanks again for listening.